When I started the company, you know, over the past several years, you know, if you ask me what's the most important thing, I always say the company culture and the company value. That's our focus. But this pandemic crisis truly taught me one more thing. That's not good enough.
Hello, world. This is Byron Dieter, and you're listening to another episode of Cloud Giants, brought to you by Bessemer Venture Partners. This is a podcast where we talk to the entrepreneurs, founders, and leaders who are building world-changing cloud companies. Today, we are here with the legendary Eric Yuan, the founder of and CEO of Zoom. Especially in the age of COVID-19 and remote work, hundreds of millions of people have used Zoom, the company delivering frictionless communications. In many ways, he's built the platform that shapes this generation. I'm thrilled to have Eric here today to share the story of this epic journey and how he's built the company that so many people depend on to stay connected for work and in personal lives. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, Byron, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let me begin by saying thank you back. On behalf of all of us who depend on Zoom in our daily lives, especially in these coronavirus times, but Zoom has become an integral part of everyday life. From heads of state using the product to just about every TV program, from CNN to The Tonight Show, down to personal events like weddings and graduations, and unfortunately, even funerals. This would be a very different time, and we'd all be much less effective and frankly, more lonely without Zoom. And so I'm eager to get into the present day topics because there is so much to discuss here, which means that we're gonna shorten a little bit of the setup where we normally talk about the early days. But I do want to hit on the Zoom Genesis story as well, because that is so intriguing and I think relevant for founders and CEOs out there. And so let's start there with, as a Chinese American, you originally grew up in China. In the late 90s, you and your family moved to the States and you joined what was at the time an early cloud company called WebEx. You sold to Cisco in 2007 and you were the vice president of engineering. In many ways, WebEx represented this first generation of web video and collaboration products. And as I understand, by about 2011, you had a lot of ideas for WebEx and how they could make significant changes and how Cisco could improve the product and the offering. Can you tell us a little bit about that pitch and what you thought could be done?
Yeah, sure. You know, I was born in China and I moved to Silicon Valley in 1997, joined WebEx. And since then, I was working on WebEx for many, many years and the company sold to Cisco. And essentially, you know, I was a founding engineer and then became a vice president of engineering. And I feel like WebEx is more like my baby, right? I never thought about leaving Cisco or WebEx to start something new. However, the year before I left, you know, every time when I talked with a WebEx customer, I felt very embarrassed because I did not see a single happy WebEx customer. I tried to understand what had happened. Finally, I realized in WebEx, the architecture was about a data collaboration. You know, customers talk about the video, talk about the voice, OIP, and the mobile experience. So I realized there's no way to fix all those modern problems by tweaking the WebEx. The only way is to build a new solution from the ground up. And Cisco is a great company. But back then, Cisco was unwilling to change its collaboration strategy. And at that time, you know, everyone talked about social networking. And also, we can sell a lot of WebEx. You know, many people told me that, hey, why do you want to cannibalize WebEx? It took me 1 year. I failed to convince others. You know, finally, I decided to leave. Because every morning when I wake up, I did not want to go to office because I was not happy. Because I, you know, my personal life also got negatively impacted. You know, I was not happy, my family not happy. Then I needed to think about what I should do next. 1 year later, I decided to leave. I'm going to try something new.
Wow. And obviously, this story plays out very well for you and the Zoom customers today that Cisco didn't listen. One interesting sub-element of this story going into the WebEx piece is that immigration is a hot topic in tech these days, and it's especially poignant when looking at your story, where you've created thousands of jobs and billions of dollars to the economy. And yet, as I understand it, that almost didn't happen. I believe your visa to the US was first denied a shocking 8 times. Can you tell a little bit about that story? Is that true?
That's true. But looking back, that's good. to practice my perseverance, right? Yes, so in 1995, I was visiting Japan, for a short period of time, around 4 months, and for training program. And I joined one of the industry events. Bill Gates was also there to give a keynote speech. I was so inspired by his speech. I realized, wow, the future is about internet. After back to Beijing, China, I wanted to come to Silicon Valley to take a look because so popularity of the Yahoo or Netscape. And I applied for the business, short-term business visa, but I got a decline. And later on, I had to talk with the WebEx, one of the co-founders, to apply for the H-1 working visa to come here to join WebEx as one of the first several founding engineers. That's a true story, but it took me almost 1.5 years. And when I landed in San Francisco airport, I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Well, the wonders of the internet today means that the inspiration that Bill Gates gave to you, I suspect you're giving to many other founders out there worldwide. And so what advice do you have to those founders specifically, and maybe even more so for those that are building 2.0 businesses, for businesses that are challengers? People early on told Google that they were crazy because there were already plenty of search engines. And similarly, when you launched Zoom, there was already, WebEx and GoToMeeting and Skype and numerous others. And yet you found a need in the market that was so acute and addressed it so well, you blew past all of them. And so what are the lessons learned if you were talking to those entrepreneurs today that are out there founding businesses or building businesses?
I think first of all, for every entrepreneur, I'm pretty sure they have their own plan or they have a dream. I think number one, I would say just do it. And when I started Zoom, I tell you, a lot of my friends told me that, Eric, please do not do it. If you do anything else, we can invest you as long as you do not build another solution. If this is your dream, just do it. That's number one. The second thing is, startup is a long journey. No way for anyone, for any company to be successful over the night. Hard work, stay humble, keep improving. I think you got to enjoy this dream. Be patient.
But were there times along the way when you legitimately went home at night or you sat there in your office and you thought, I don't think we're going to make it? Where you literally thought, what the heck did I do? This thing isn't going to work.
There are so many times in the night, I just cannot sleep. Sometimes your customer cancel your service and you have a key team member, who just left. So many challenges, coming from all the corners. You're suffering from that. But the good news for me is when I started a company, I was already, I think a little bit older, right? Age 41. And in the night, I cannot sleep. But when I woke up, I always reminded myself where I was coming from. I came here in 1997, and I finally can start a company because of the great culture of Silicon Valley. I had a dream. Every morning when I woke up, I can recharge myself.
Tell me just a little bit more about that. How do you specifically do that? How do you find your center? You talked about one of the big reasons you left Cisco is you just weren't happy. How do you find happy in a crisis or when things around you look bleak?
Yeah, so first of all, I know the purpose of life is to pursue happiness. And the happiness comes from making others happy. So if every day when I wake up as a CEO of Zoom, if I always think about how to make sure our employee happy, I feel very happy. And also together, if you can make a customer happy, I feel very happy. That's the reason why every morning when I wake up, I have a full energy. I can recharge myself, do all I can to look at everything from our employee and from a customer perspective. I think that's the key. Otherwise, given what's happening, for sure, and the pressure, you might give up. But for me, I always think about how to make others happy. That's a key to keep myself happy.
You've been able to deliver on that core mission in a fantastic way, even more so in the recent months as your reach has broadened. But what was the early set of insights to help bring that product to market. What helped position you in this competitive field? Was there a true north that you steadily articulated and said, we just need to do this? You've talked about the unhappy customers and how that was your mission. But what specifically was it about the product or the distribution model or the engagement model that you felt needed to be disrupted? And what do you think has caused Zoom to break ahead of this pack?
I think, first of all, you know, many years ago, before we introduced our product, we knew one thing for sure is that ease of use, that's very critical. You know, one of the key reasons why any user, they even do not want to try any video conference service is that it's so hard to use. You need to click 10 clicks and install a very big software. And finally, when you start using that, guess what? The video is does not work. The audio is very choppy. And they never wanted to try. So we focus on ease of use and audio and video quality. So that's our focus for the first several years.
And then you have a go-to-market model that approximates some of these freemium or developer-led models. There are developer evangelist models that are working. And yet, going back to your notion of happiness, you literally describe this outreach crew as happiness crews. And so much so that I understand a lot of this is volunteer-based. And can you explain your volunteer model or the go-to-market model and how you've been able to make these happiness crews work in the early days in building awareness and education in a market that was so competitive and in a space that, you know, was in need of a dramatically different approach?
When you build any product, you got to have a very loyal, you know, user base. If you cannot find a very loyal user community, it's really hard. If you can find that, that'd be great. You can keep listening to them, keep improving, and send your new feature to them. But how to establish a very loyal user community? You know, from our perspective, we think about, first of all, we got to give all the features. We give all the features for free for one-to-one. When it comes to multiple participant video conferencing, we also give all the features for free, but limit the meeting to 40 minutes. After 40 minutes, if you want, you can start another meeting. We still can allow you to do that. And plus, if any customers, if they cancel the service, in the early days, I'll always personally reach out, try to understand what had happened, keep improving. And after that, we tell customer, hey, we already fixed this problem. Do you want to try again? Or I give you free access. And with that, with several years effort, we can establish a very loyal user community. And after that, everything else is relatively straightforward and easier.
And two of those elements, I think, are particularly intriguing for our listeners. One is around the pricing strategy, this idea that minutes would be the trigger for the upsell versus specific, data volumes or users or those sorts of things. And then the other is your involvement with customer support, where literally the CEO was going into customer records and trying to diagnose those. Can you tell me a little bit about your inspiration for both? Did you have other companies to pull from as you constructed that pricing strategy? And then what caused you to be so customer focused in the very early days?
I think over the past several years, quite often our sales team, they told me that, Eric, we got to increase the price. We add more features. Customer also told us we can. I always told them no. Our philosophy is always to make sure you add more value. At the same time, keep the same price. Because down the road, customers even realize it. Wow, I paid $14.99. You keep adding more and more features, giving more and more value, but you still keep the same price. With that, you can establish trust. I wanted to build a culture. Everyone got to look at everything from customer perspective. Always care about the customers. If I do not do it, I always talk about that. You got to do lead by example. That's the reason why if I do that, all others will do that as well. So that's the reason why. When it comes to price, greater product and more value, don't increase price. At the same time, build the culture, customer focus.
And so you were willing to leave money on the table in terms of customer love and value to get that deep usage engagement. And you started to see momentum building, I suspect, fairly early on. But in hindsight, what was that moment when you first looked back and said, this may be huge? Not only is this starting to work, but we may actually take over this market. Was there a specific moment that you can look at when that first hit you?
I think 2012, the summertime, and we reached out to Walt Mossberg, you know, he's a very famous journalist, you know, and to let him test Zoom and ask about writing an article. We did not realize he's going to write one. Not only did he write one, but also write a very positive one. And also he personally recorded a video. After I played his video, at that moment, I realized, oh, maybe we're onto something. I think it truly boosted our confidence. I think that's a moment. Looking back, I still appreciate for his great, you know, article.
That's fantastic. And there were many of these inflection points in the company history, certainly some of them very recently. But let's talk about the IPO next. I loved your roadshow because you took meetings over Zoom. And I remember sitting in the roadshow lunch in San Francisco in person with the bankers and investors, just a few dozen miles from your headquarters. And yet you had dozens of your team members Zoom into the discussion, of course, instead of attending in person. And so talk a little bit about the process and also, what are your takeaways from it? I assume that you would say that the process is a bit outdated and that a lot more roadshows could happen over video. Anything else you'd take away from that or that you'd like to see changed in light of you testing the status quo there?
You know, I do not like traveling, right? I would say, hey, if you can use Zoom for IPO roadshow, that'd be cool. And guess what? You know, for some of the, you know, the investors, they like it. And some other investors, because it's the first time, you know, a lot of people told me that, Eric, you really cannot do it. And the week before your IPO, you got to fly to New York to meet with all the big investors. Otherwise, they may not support you. I thought about a lot. Finally, I sort of still a little bit stubborn. I think, no matter what, I think I want to try. You know, looking back, I think it's good I made that decision. But now recently, I think during this COVID-19 crisis, and quite a few companies, they did that as well. It works. It just works.
It worked spectacularly well for you and also created in many ways a richer experience because you're able to expose more of the company, give the product that real world sense to the audience and make it tangible, which is what so much of the roadshow is about. And so clearly quite effective and for a lot of reasons, many companies are following your lead now.
But also for our quarterly earnings call as well, we also use Zoom. I also enjoy that experience as well.
Well, and we're going to get to a lot more people following your lead. So, but let's talk about the start of 2021. And many of us didn't know what was about to happen around COVID-19. However, Zoom has hundreds of employees in China with deep ties to China, which probably informed many of your early decisions, because I suspect you were seeing it and hearing about it much earlier. When did you start to feel that this pandemic was going to have major implications? And what steps did you take early on as a leader for your own employees and business? And then we're going to talk about what you did for so many others.
So when the pandemic crisis started, you know, started from China, and also we offered a service, all of us, we never realized any other countries might have something similar. But very soon, and we see the usage and in Europe, in Italy, and in Japan, in Korea, in other countries. And finally, in the service, the capacity, we also had a big problem here. Then we realized, wow, we got to take a step back. Look at all of our 17 data centers. What can we do? There's no way for us to deploy tens of thousands, you know, servers in our cloud. And as we have to have a solution, how to leverage public cloud, you know, to serve the world. You know, on the one hand, we realized, wow, this is something really serious. On the other hand, we took a very, you know, some quick actions, right, to add our capacity, because this is a time for us to show our corporate social responsibility. Essentially, you have a dream, you want to build a service, a company to make the world a better place. This is the best time for us, you know, to showcase, you know, our corporate social responsibility.
The entrepreneurs listening right now dream of the positive side of that, which is the business growth, and to have that tornado effect of demand, which unfortunately this was a negative catalyst, but you responded in such a positive way to help the community, both the business and personal community. Can you share some of the metrics that you've repeated, you know, publicly, nothing confidential, but talk through some of the metrics that took you by surprise and some of those December to March statistics that are so shocking and capture growth rates that are almost unprecedented in the enterprise cloud space?
Yeah, one of the key metrics we measure here is about daily meeting participant. Now, back to December, our peak day is around 10 million, you know, daily meeting participants. But in April, that number, I think, reached to 300 million daily meeting participants. This is a huge jump. And plus, used to be, you look at the daily usage, I think around, you know, more than 70% of the users are from our paid business or enterprise users. But during this pandemic crisis, the free users, the first-time consumers, we hire now paid users. Plus, not only do we serve like North America, Europe, or Japan, or India, Canada, guess what? More than 80 countries users. We never, you know, market ourselves there, but guess what? It just happens. You know, so many users from so many countries, you know, are using our service. This is amazing. And looking back, I still do not believe that is, you look at our app, the mobile app, Zoom app suddenly ranks number one for more than 60 days in a row. That's one metric I just feel very proud about our team's great work.
It's just spectacular when you consider that you were already the leading product. You had a wildly successful IPO. You were worth billions of dollars. You were rolling through enterprise use cases in spectacular fashion. And just to repeat, you said that over 4 months, you had a 30x increase in your primary metric around meetings and engagement, something that is inconceivable in a pre-cloud era. And as you said, even with a architecture that was optimized for cloud scale, your team was scrambling, just couldn't imagine this spectacular success. And so I'm sure your team was maxed out already with a full product roadmap and in sprint mode. What did you change and how did you rally the company in those times to possibly handle it? What things did you have to strip out and what things became your core priorities just to survive, nonetheless thrive in this time?
You know, several things. First of all, we got to keep adding capacity, also keep the service up. And plus, given that we have so many, you know, first-time users, all kinds of use cases, and you know, the privacy and the security are becoming more and more critical, because not only do we work together with enterprise or business customers, even if you have all those security features, guess what? How to make it simple, make it a package, enforce those security features like a password, like a waiting room. Those are becoming very important to embrace first-time users. That's why, you know, over the past several months, our team is working so hard. Our philosophy is always like this. Hey, don't look at this problem from this perspective. Think about fast forward to 2040, 2050. When we look back, when you talk with the younger version of yourself, are you doing the right thing for the world? Are you doing the right thing to keep delivering happiness to the users?
It's absolutely remarkable that you've been able to absorb that scale and do exactly that, deliver a stable world-class product that so many users worldwide are now depending on. And again, this was that demand event that so many companies hope to create through a number of, you know, Walt Mossberg pieces or through some, you know, release. And you had it through this global event that was unifying. You were self-critical in saying you wish you'd thought through some different market approaches and realized that it was going to be global, which is a very humble approach given how visionary and proactive you were here. But are there things that you would take as maybe general pieces of advice for those who are fortunate enough to have these massive demand spikes in terms of how they should think through it? Are there things you would have done differently? Are there lessons that you took away from this event that how you would handle things in a different approach if it were to happen again?
When I started a company, you know, over the past several years, you know, if you ask me what's the most important thing, I always say the company culture and the company value. That's our focus. But this pandemic crisis truly taught me one more thing. That's not good enough. When you suddenly you have a crisis like this, you know, pandemic crisis, suddenly your metrics grow like 30 times. There are a lot of areas might be broken. You have to delegate it to your team to fix all those issues, to embrace the growth. If you do not write down your business principle, guess what? Quite often, you are going to make a lot of mistakes here and there. But how to make sure to follow your business principles, that's a key. Now, actually, we are doubling down on that.
So that's a fantastic example of making business principles and values tangible, because sometimes you'll hear leaders who say, I'm going too fast. I don't have time to do this. But your point is in many ways the opposite, that by explicitly writing them down, by prioritizing them at the hardest points, at the most stressful moments, you turn to your principles as a way of prioritizing and structuring your company and helping probably your executives figure out for themselves what to do.
You're so right. Looking back, if we already, you know, write down all those business principles, guess what? The journey will be much more smooth. You know, however, the good news, we learned that, but looking back, that's the number one mistake. That's the number one lesson I learned.
That's fantastic and actionable. And I want to use that as the jumping off point to the present day, where world leaders are using Zoom to govern. And the major news outlets are using Zoom to communicate to the world. The Fortune 2000 businesses use Zoom for internal, external communications. And as we touched on a personal front, the weddings and even funerals and high school graduations are now happening over Zoom. What goes through your mind when you see these use cases? And maybe can you tell us about some of these particularly inspiring use cases that you've been made aware of over the last couple of weeks and months that have really made this tangible for you?
Yeah, first of all, I think, you know, we believe a video is a new voice, and a video collaboration will become a mainstream service. This pandemic crisis just accelerated that vision. And having said that, I think Zoom is not only used for business use cases anymore. So the boundary between a consumer use case or home use case or office or business use case is not clear anymore, right? So meaning anywhere, very similar to a phone call. You can call your anywhere with any device. It's going to happen to the video communication as well. And that's why you look at all those the new use cases. The one, you know, use case in particular, the Zoom marriage is legal in New York, right? And you already planned for many, many years. Suddenly, because of COVID-19, I think you still can't get married, you know, over Zoom platform. You know, every time when I think about that use case, I feel very excited to finally realize, yes, 9 or 10 years hard work is well paid off.
The most significant event for many people, their wedding, is now a Zoom event. And as you talk about delivering happiness, I could see why that would be immensely satisfying. And you probably have a better perspective than just about anyone else in terms of what do you think happens from here when we have a vaccine that's readily available? Do you think that life has been permanently altered in that will offices ever be the same? Will remote work be the norm? Do you feel like a lot of these patterns are going to persist?
Yes, they are going to. I think the way for us to live, to play, to work is completely different. You know, after this pandemic crisis over, it's very likely, I think nobody, you know, not like before, everyone got to go back to office to work. Used to be employer, they are going to make the decision. Now, I think an employee will make the decision. You know, we have a very flexible working policy. So very likely it'll be hybrid. You know, maybe twice a day, a week, every employee can go back to home to work. Or maybe some employees, they want to work at home today or tomorrow go to office. It's very flexible. That will drive a digital transformation for every business. You got to look at how to support remote workforce. No matter where they are, they still can't get the job done. Make sure there's no productivity loss. I think a huge opportunity for every business to embrace this new paradigm shifting to the remote working mode.
And on the competitive front, you've taken on the world's largest, Microsoft with Skype, Google with Hangouts, Cisco with your own WebEx, Apple with FaceTime, and numerous others. And you've beaten them all so far with a better product and a more compelling business. It's been so public and in many ways so embarrassing for those companies, though, that they're now throwing massive resources at these products. And you've got new entrants like Facebook even jumping into the market. What do you think happens to this product space post-COVID? Have you awoken an entire wave of competitors that may now be credible when you'd already beaten them?
That's a good question. The good news, we did not take on any of those competitors. Otherwise, we cannot have a good sleep. Otherwise, I even do not dare to start Zoom. Because if you look at any competitive landscape, there's three things. Your company, your competitors, and customers. If you laser focus on your customers, your users, don't look at what your competitors do. Then you can sleep well. Then you can deliver a better service, more innovations to serve your end users. Otherwise, you look at all those competitors' name, you will think about, oh wow, they might catch up tomorrow. The more you are thinking, the more you are going to look at what they are doing. Then you spend less time on serving your customers.
And amazingly applicable, even with the world's largest companies with products that aspire to be competitive. We should probably put some other metrics around this, starting with the market cap of Zoom 4 or so years ago was about $1 billion, which seemed like a big number at the time. And then the company had this fantastic IPO and you traded up to $17 billion in January of 2020. So a few months ago from when this podcast is being recorded. Even at some points during that, you said that, oh, this is a full price or the multiples seem high for the industry. And yet a few months into this COVID pandemic, the market capitalization crossed $70 billion, which was a 4x change in a few months and 70 times change in a handful of years. And so what goes through your mind with these staggering changes? And what are the messages to your team as they're seeing this and looking at the stock price and counting the value of their options?
So that's a great question. Well, first of all, I'm an engineer. So for anything that is out of our control, normally I do not pay attention to. For anything that is under our control, I will like to jump in to look at what's going on. You look at the stock price, if you keep looking at the stock price, I guarantee you, cannot sleep well. Either you are too excited or you are too nervous, right? That's why I told our employees, let's keep improving our product and service. Let's keep adding more and more innovations and make sure every user, every customer, they are happy. And the stock price, out of our control, they are going to follow in the long run. Don't look at the stock price. Otherwise, I know one thing for sure, many years ago when I was at WebEx, when engineers, when they always look at the stock price, stock price is up, your product quality is good. Stock price is down, your quality is down as well. That's why I say don't look at the stock price. So that's always our philosophy.
I'm impressed if you've been able to hold that discipline. And sorry if I ruined the news to you, but congratulations on what continues to be pretty spectacular stock performance. In this process, you've become a tech celebrity, where people now think of Zoom and you personally as household names in many cases. And I've got to imagine that staying focused is much harder these days. And I know you've got a number of management techniques that you used, at least in the early days. Are you still able to do the same things? Do you attempt to have the moments of reflection to start your day and end each day? And how are you personally trying to lead through this time? And what have you adapted in your style to still be successful in the middle of this complete tornado of success?
So first of all, we feel very fortunate. We started a company here in Silicon Valley. I lived here for many, many years, learned from so many other successful entrepreneurs and leaders. I'm so grateful. I also have so many mentors here. They all taught me one thing. Eric, no matter what you do, always hard work, hard work, hard work, right? Even my father told me that as well. My father told me that hard work and stay humble. At the same time, a lot of leaders, you know, even before I started or over the past several years or even recently, they told me that no matter what, always think about what you and your company can do to the world and be humble. Humanity is really important, right? That's why, you know, every day, no matter what's happening outside, every night before I sleep, I always think about, you know, hard work, stay humble, do the good things for the world, and be paranoid, and also appreciate, you know, appreciate for what others, you know, they have to ask. So you are so right. Every day, I spend some time on reflection of today, and also yesterday, and in the future. And that's really, I do enjoy, because this is how I learn from other successful companies and the leaders.
Your humility is inspiring, and the hard work is appreciated, particularly now when the world needs it so much. And I thank you for that again. Okay, so we're going to hop over to the rapid fire questions. I'm going to ask you a short one or two sentence setup, and I want you to share the first thing that pops into your mind in response. Okay, you ready for it?
Yes.
Excellent. Number one, what's the daily ritual you appreciate the most?
All the customer support and all the employees' hard work.
What websites do you visit daily, and what information sources do you love?
I like to read all those feedback from our employees or from end users.
What cloud product, other than Zoom, of course, was most critical for you in building your business?
I would say, you know, like Amazon or Oracle Cloud, and those two are the public cloud, you know, partners.
What's your favorite Zoom virtual background that you've ever seen?
Actually, whenever I talk with any customers, I like to use their either office or campus. Like for now, I'm using the Bessemer office image as my virtual background.
I loved it. I think I was going to ask you about that. What's one thing you wish you did more of when you were a first-time entrepreneur?
To have a sense of humor. That's very important. In early days, in the startup, it's hard work, and quite often, if you have a sense of humor, and some team will enjoy it, you also will enjoy it more.
How do you want to be remembered 10 years from today?
During COVID-19, Zoom did the right thing for the world.
Cheers to that. And you seem to be well on the way, Eric. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, that's our show. A huge thank you to Eric Yuan for coming on to Cloud Giants and offering your incredible experiences as the co-founder and CEO of Zoom. For the founders and entrepreneurs looking for more resources on these topics we covered today, be sure to check out all of our materials at Bessemer by going to bvp.com/cloud. And if you could do me a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you'd rate and review the podcast on Apple or wherever you're listening. It really does help others find the show. Or better yet, share this episode on social media or send it to a fellow entrepreneur. We're living in a cloud-first world, and we want these stories from top CEOs to help tomorrow's leaders. Until next time, I'm Byron Dieter, your host of Cloud Giants.